Welcome to the bookshelf, and welcome back to The Desk on the Sea, written and read by Jonathan Johnson. In tonight's episode, as the Christmas season begins, Jonathan, Amy, and Anya travel to London.
Sooner or later, almost everyone goes through life with the dead. The young and lucky, which included me, get away with loving only the living. It's one of the great, largely unrecognized reasons we envy the young. So many of them can lay eyes on every face they've ever loved. Sooner or later, though, if they last long enough themselves, their world is remade by death. For the rest of their lives, the once young and no longer so lucky travel with their lost ones, too. Every day fills with numberless reminders, threads back to the face, the hands, the voice. Among the UK expressions I like is the word sort, used as a quick little verb for to make things right. It can apply to everything from your finances to your emotions. When things are sorted, they are square with the world. Your responsibility's been met. The other day, when Amy, Anya, and I arrived at the school gate, Anya saw her classmates in their kilts and concluded that she was supposed to have worn hers, not brought it in her pack to change into later. They were all going to take a field trip down the coast to Anstruther, the next village over, for a Scottish dance gathering of Fife primary schools. Thinking, rightly it turned out, that she could easily change into her kilt once they got to the hall in Anstruther, we hadn't even packed her tights, so if she did dash into the school and change now, she'd be freezing on the trip. That mattered not a whit, of course. Her friends were all in their kilts. When she saw them, she turned around to Amy, tears already welling in her eyes. "I'll run home and get your tights," I said, and was off. Behind me, I heard the bell ring. Later, Amy told me that Anya lined up and went in with the other children, still visibly upset. Amy stood at the school gate and waited for me to return, and fretted to our new friend and fellow parent, Debbie Stamper. "Well, go in there and get her sorted," Debbie said. And Amy did. When I got back, tights in hand, Amy was at the school door and told me she'd gone in and asked Mrs. Lang, and of course it was fine for Anya to change later. But Anya still wanted to change right away. She loves her kilt. 6 months before we moved to Scotland, she began wearing it around the house and even out to play and around town. And today, her classmates were in theirs, and she wasn't. Tights delivered and one 8-year-old's crisis averted, Amy and I left. On the way home, she told me how Debbie had used the term sorted for what Anya needed us to do for her. Such an elegant and economical word. My mom would have loved it. The word and the sense of responsibility it conveys. The dead we love are always that close at hand. Anything we touch in a day, anything we hear or say can reveal them. For at least as long as we remember, the world that goes on keeps an unseen place for them. I can feel my mother in me when I'm taking care. Like her, among the ways I feel most square with the world, most sorted myself, is when I'm getting things sorted for my family. Running Anya's tights up to school so she can change into her kilt and feel part of the gang. Sitting over her homework at the kitchen table after I've done the dishes, and helping her figure out how many of 10 slices of pizza make 1/5. Calling my dad on a Sunday to swap news. More snow in Upper Michigan, he tells me. Tucking Anya in after her story, and climbing into bed next to Amy and telling her I love her, and listening to how she's doing so far from her parents and sister and old friends. Sorted. My mother would have said it often. The adults funneled into the Crail Community Hall to watch the children dance the old dances at the Cayley. A Cayley, Anya had explained to Amy and me, is pronounced Cayley and is a gathering for Scottish music and often country dancing. This one's an annual event put on by the Crail School. We adults took our seats around the perimeter, and soon the children entered in kilts, smart white shirts, and plaid sashes, and filled the middle of the room. Two old gents, one on accordion and the other on keyboard, sent music up the stone pillars and into the high wood rafters of the old hall, and the children started in, Anya right with them. Her long blonde hair fanned out and turned with her spins. Her cheeks soon flushed red, and her brow set with seriousness of purpose as she and her partner, little Paul with glasses and close-cropped hair, sashayed down the middle of two rows of classmates. Her brow softened, and she broke into a wide smile as she and Paul parted and she pivoted back into line. The adults clapped along in time until the last dance, when our children came and took us by the hands and led us from our seats out onto the floor. Some of the parents knew these dances. I could see it from their ease with the moves. Many of them went to Crail Primary themselves and danced at a Kaylee right here and led their own parents out to the floor. They knew what to do. But we all let our children guide us through the patterns. Let them find the music and lead us. It's what parents the world over do. Teach our children the patterns we know as our cultures, and let them make those patterns their own. I've seen it often in Scotland, partly because so much of the culture is new to me, and partly because the country is in the midst of a resurgence of national pride. For nearly a millennium, national pride has never been in short supply in Scotland. But now, as the Scottish population contemplates the nature of its relationship to the United Kingdom, the people are eager to celebrate again the patterns by which they live, the movements of their dances, the geometries of their tartans and tweeds and argyles, the literature of their language. Every student in the school has chosen a Scottish poem to memorize, many of them in Scots or peppered with Gaelic. Anya picked The Fox Without a Tail, as told by Robert Stephen. The poem begins, "A fox was once taken in a trap, but he managed to get free by biting off his bushy tail. There was nothing else to do." Perfect for my little vegetarian, with her fascination for foxes and for bodily injuries. But it was 12 verses long, and with Scots vocabulary in each verse. When poetry recitation day came, though, she had it down. Again, parents sat in chairs watching their children inherit the patterns many of them inherited in this same school. There was plenty of Hugh McDermid, even more Robert Burns. Public recitation brought out the children's thickest accents, of course, and often I couldn't tell what was written in Scots and what was simply a kid's pronunciation. But then, that was the idea, wasn't it? A reminder of the continuity of the language. Anya's name was called, and I could see her trying to suppress her smile as she strode to the front. She got every word, every yea and fin, and managed a little acting inflection even, when the fox says, "I cannot live this way, a fox without a tail." American kids learn a bit of Whitman here and there, maybe. Perhaps very occasionally some Dickinson. But I'd seen nothing like this back home. Every child in the village school learning a poem by heart, a new poem every year, to be said before an audience at public recitation day. The poet in me was as pleased as the parent to have chosen Scotland for the year. A couple nights later, Amy, Anya, and I walked up to the high street for the Christmas tree lighting and parade. Children had been encouraged to wear Santa hats, and Anya had on hers. Perhaps 100 villagers followed 6 motorcycles sparkling with colored lights the 150 yards from the East Newk Hotel to the Christmas tree across the street from the co-op store. Why motorcycles, I have no idea. But there was Santa on the back of the lead bike, driven by Carl, the town mechanic. At the tree, there was mulled wine and soup and minced pies, all compliments of the village. And we were among friends. Alan and Debbie Stamper and their son Callum had closed their tea room early and come up. Debbie is as big a lover of Christmas as Amy, and the two of them talked about how they might decorate our table at the upcoming Christmas party. They quickly settled on an international theme, little flags and cutouts and paraphernalia from Christmases around the world. People began to shout, 10, 9, 8, as the tree lighting countdown started. At 0, the lights came on to great applause. Then someone led us in 3 cheers of, "Hip, hip, hooray!" I leaned over and said in Debbie's ear, "I didn't think anyone actually said that anymore." "You got a problem with tradition?" she gave back. "Quite the contrary," I said, and took a mouthful of warm mulled wine. In the village church a couple hours later, the little choir of Crail children in their school uniforms strode seriously down the aisle to the riser in front of us. As Anya passed, I saw that familiar smile she can't quite hide when she's in front of a crowd. While the children sang, "O Christmas Tree," I stole glances at the faces of some of the old people watching. The approval and contentment in their eyes was unmistakable. I've seen it in the eyes of old people watching children sing everywhere I've been. Old people and young people. In one wee village church on the stony, grassy end of a peninsula jutting into the North Sea. Every Christmas since the church's consecration in 1243, the old handing over the world to the young, again and again and again. The world made new, every time. Whatever else Christmas means, it means that. Renewal. It's obvious in an old place like Crail, but it's just as true everywhere. Each of us dies to sink away with all our lifetime's cargo of wonders and griefs and memories. But even as we each go down alone, the humanity we are goes on. Grief goes on, yes, but so does wonder. New days make themselves into memories in new people. The thought itself is an old one, older than the oldest village church. But watching Anya sing, hearing her voice, now distinct, now blending with the voices of the other children around her, I felt as though I just that moment discovered how humanity goes on. I turned 41 on my first day in London. The sounds of motorbikes and cabs and buses making the turn below our hotel room woke me before sunrise. I rose quietly and took a run through Hyde and Green Parks, down to Buckingham Palace, and saw the sky brighten to gold in the east above Big Ben. When I got back to the room, Amy and Anya were up and had my presents and cards spread out on the king-size bed. At the National Gallery, we played the game we invented several years ago for Anya, in which we first visit a museum's gift shop, she chooses three or four postcards that we purchase, and then we search for the corresponding paintings as we tour the collection. As she always does, she chose images of animals. A white deer in the medieval panels of Wilton Diptych, a detail of the tiger in Rousseau's Surprised, and the horse in George Stubbs' Whistle Jacket. While Anya searched these out, holding open the gallery map, Amy and I got to take in the passing works. We stopped her now and then to admire something. She especially appreciated Van Gogh's sunflowers. But then she'd be back on the hunt, map in one hand, postcard in the other. To her delight, the horse in Whistle Jacket turned out to be both life-size and incredibly lifelike. As she stood beneath its sinewy, marble-veined legs, I wandered across the room to the Turners on the opposite wall. Rain, steam, and speed, the Great Western Railway, the Evening Star, Margate from the Sea, paintings I'd known from reproductions in my own childhood. Down the wall a bit was John Constable's The Hay Wain, with its cottage and dog and farmers driving a wagon through a pond. My parents had checked out a print of The Hay Wain from a university library once and hung it for a while on our apartment wall. Now when I stood before the original, I recalled the hauntingly familiar details, the red and brown spots on the English setter, the weathered gray wood spokes on the wagon wheels. My mother never saw these originals, of course, just as she never saw Grasmere Lake or Dove Cottage. From my parents, I learned to love art and study, and I learned the moves it took to turn my love of art and study into a great job with research travel budgets and year-long sabbaticals. The children of working people, my parents had to learn those university moves for themselves. My father was nearly my age when he got his first teaching position, and my mother's health unraveled too much for her to finish her PhD. She was 52 before they bought their first and only house. She never got to see the places that inspired the poems she loved, or the originals of the paintings she studied in books and hung in prints on our student family apartment walls. My mother's joy came instead from the spirit of the works. Wordsworth's word built Grasmere in her mind as she walked across campus. The thought of Turner's clouds when she looked at her own skies. Hers was the dizzying pleasure of the seminar room, abuzz with conversation. The after-hours thunking of the keys of a typewriter chained to the desk of a teaching assistant bullpen office as she spoke back to the art that had renewed the world for the orphan daughter of alcoholics. Then, when her health began its long slide, and she no longer had the energy or endurance for advanced scholarship or teaching, she boxed up her two unfinished dissertation manuscripts and bought flowers. With dozens of planter boxes and pots, she turned the little deck of our apartment into a sanctuary of colors and scents and riotous blossoms. My sister recently reminded me of our mother's tulips that still bloom from a narrow strip of earth beside that apartment every spring. A tiny moment of cheer in someone's day from an anonymous gardener not quite gone. When my mother and father finally bought their little house, she did the same for the backyard. With no bitterness that I ever witnessed, she let all her academic aspirations go and turned the precious health and energy she had left to those flowers, and to my father and sister and me, and to living inside each day as it came. The rest of us got where we wanted to go in our careers, and my mother reveled in our successes, participated in them as she participated in each opening rose and pansy. Each of our triumphs was her triumph. She encouraged, coached, and believed in the things we did. She proofread and gave me feedback on every academic paper I wrote, and did the same for my sister. Whenever she was well enough, she'd mark my dad's students' papers for him. "It's something I can do to contribute, and I like doing it," she'd say. I remember her sitting in the last years of her life in a chair in the kidney dialysis unit, a tube out, her blood turning through the machine beside her, a tube in, and a stack of those student papers on her lap, a yellow plastic mechanical pencil in her hand. For every paper, no matter how clunky or downright poor the prose, she found something encouraging to write in the margin, good or well put or smart, at least once or twice. Masterful as she was at encouragement, it is a shame she didn't get a long teaching life. She had a few terms of part-time adjunct teaching at Northern Michigan University in Marquette when we first moved there. And Marquette's the sort of town in which the good one does has a way of coming back to you, even years later. A little like bulbs deep in the earth, rising again and again to the sun. Nurses at the hospital or in home health saw my mother's name on patient rosters and stopped in to thank her. They told her how, when they had gone back to school as adults and studied freshman composition with her, her belief in them had helped them feel they belonged in college, and how she taught them to articulate their ideas and enabled them to do college work and go on to the lives and jobs they had now. Even when the classroom was far behind her, she still managed to have that same kind of influence. She befriended the new dialysis technician who sometimes plugged her into those machines. Diane was good at her job but frazzled by the demands of single motherhood. She was just getting by on what she made. She often looked tired and harried. My mom got her talking about her life and her dreams and soon convinced her to apply for the RN degree program at the university. She even helped her fill out the applications and financial aid paperwork. And when Diane got into the program and left her job at the dialysis unit to study, my mom and dad hired her to cook a few meals a week and do some housekeeping so she would have enough cash to keep going. Am I trying to convince myself that it's all right that my mother never got to go to Grasmere or see a Turner painting? Sure. But it's not right. It's supremely unfair. Still, for her, it was okay. I have a good life. Again and again, I hear her inflection on good, her contentment. And today, I remember another birthday. Anya's first, June 8, exactly 7.5 years ago. Amy's family and mine gathered in the log pavilion overlooking Lake Superior at Marquette's Presque Isle Park. When we were done singing Happy Birthday, and Anya was done squeezing cake in her fingers, my mother, who was already under doctor's orders to stay off her foot, took Anya for a ride on her lap as I pushed her wheelchair. Amy got some old bread my parents had in the car, and I pushed my mother and daughter to the end of the little asphalt path, just before the grass and trees ended, at a sandstone ledge over the water. There, the world seemed to come to us. Seagulls sailed over and swirled and called as my mother and Anya threw crumbs to them. After each crumb, Anya looked up at her grandmother, who threw another or tore some more from a slice and handed it to her to toss. The gulls flew and hovered in the breeze and held the air very close around us. For a few seconds, we were among them. Those few seconds are among the happiest I have ever known. They travel with me, my mother's lesson in contentment. Even as my own good life, comfortable academic life that it is, has taken me far from there. But the word comfortable hardly suffices for the life in which I find myself at 41. Privileged is closer, I suppose. Privileged both in what I have and can do in my life, and privileged in my capacity to value and fully inhabit that life. My mother tended. She tended the imaginations and self-confidences and spirits of those around her. And because she did, I have this life of privilege, as do Amy and Anya, and my father and sister, and to various extents many other people. Home from the train ride from London, I pulled our car Pigeon into the little Crail Harbor, quiet and deserted in the night, and parked. While Amy and I hoisted suitcases from the trunk, Anya asked if she could go down to the beach to say goodnight to the North Sea. It had been a long haul, and we were tired. But what parent could say no to a request like that? "Just for a minute, then come right up," Amy told her. After all the commotion and abundance of London, it was good to return to the voices of waves and piping of red shanks in the harbor, the only sounds beside the wheels of our suitcase as we walked toward the cottage. Privileged is certainly a better word for this life of ours than comfortable, but privileged seems insufficient as well. Loved. That's it. Ours are loved lives. My academic skills and career that have given us a year in a cottage on the Scottish coast and allowed us to stand in magnificent places and before great works of art, our appreciation for and kindness toward one another, my passion for poetry, my belief in my capacities as a father and partner and teacher and friend, all of it has roots deep in my mother's love. I can feel that love in our days, wherever we go, nurturing and sustaining us, tending us still. Pocket Journal Entry, Marquette, Day 3, February 4. The day begins with artificial tears. My father held the dropper to my mother's eyes and let the drops fall, then wiped the overflow from her cheeks. Among everything her body's failings will take, the ability to make her own tears is already gone. She cannot even weep for herself. Amy and Anya arrived today. They arrived at the house just as I was wheeling Mom in her wheelchair out to the living room. Mom's eyes were closed, as they often are now. I leaned down and told her, "Nana, Anya's here." "Hi, baby," my mom said and pursed her lips. We lifted Anya. They exchanged kisses, and Anya gave her a big squeeze. When Amy and Anya had settled in and the house had quieted down, I asked Mom if she would like me to read some poetry, and she nodded faintly. I read, "I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud." The pair of lines in the freckled skin between her eyebrows showed her deep recognition as they lifted and pushed together. I asked if she was okay. I asked if I should go on. She nodded again. I reread the opening, and all through the rest by memory, one of the first poems she ever read to me. Later, when she was tucked in bed listening to Leonard Cohen's song, "Everybody Knows," a brooding favorite of hers, I asked if she wanted me to read the poem again, and she nodded. I paused the song and read. At the end, after, "For oft when on my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude, and then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils," I whispered in her ear, "I'm there with you."
Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to The Bookshelf on Spokane Public Radio. Join us next time to continue Jonathan Johnson's memoir, The Desk on the Sea. Music for this episode is by Caerdwin and Greg Spatz. I'm Ben Reed.